Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody. Bienvenidos, bienvenidas. Welcome back to New Books Network. This is Pamela Fuentes, editor of New Books Network in Español. Today, we'll be talking to Carlos Alberto Sánchez about A Sense of Brutality, Philosophy After Narcoculture. This book was published in 2020 by Amherst College Press. Carlos, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
It is great to have you. And just to let the audience know, we have a version in Spanish or an interview in Spanish about this book. So if you want to listen to this one and then the one in Spanish, please do it. Let's begin the interview with a brief introduction. Please tell us a bit about yourself.
Well, my name is Carlos Alberto Sánchez. I am a professor of philosophy at San Jose State University, where I have been teaching philosophy since 2006. I write mostly about Mexican thought and culture. In the area of philosophy, so the history of Mexican philosophy, and this book is I consider it part of that interest. So that's just a little bit about me.
Great, and let's start literally by the beginning. In the first paragraph, we read that this book deals with a phenomenon that might seem to fall outside the scope of philosophy, considering philosophy in its traditional sense. Tell us how you came to write this book and how narcoculture can be studied from a philosophical perspective.
Yeah, well, the reason why I wanted to write this book was because I felt as a Mexican American, I feel like the need to put philosophy into the practice of understanding my community. And all the different phenomena that kind of make it up and that travel and traffic within it. And one of the things that always impacted me was the influence of narcoculture on the Mexican community in the United States. And the way that it was portrayed in the media, the way that it's portrayed in all the different areas of life in our community. And I was surprised to see that everybody considered it to be just that, a form of entertainment, some sort of passing cultural phenomenon that was just isolated to a particular time and place. And I thought that was the wrong way to think about narcoculture. And I started looking into it. And of course, the first thing that you notice is the hundreds of thousands of people that have died as a result of the rise of narco trafficking in the last, 40 years. So I began to think about what could we say philosophically about that phenomenon. And so one of the things that motivated me to write the book was this, the many different treatments of other violent situations, other violent cultures, other moments of violence and death that have occurred in the 20th century and all over the world, and the way that philosophers have reacted to that, right? So I'm talking, of course, about like the Holocaust. I'm talking about 9/11. I'm talking about big moments of death and destruction that have happened in the last century and how philosophers have reacted to that. And here we are with over 200,000 people dead and nobody's talking about it philosophically, right? And I thought that somebody should write about that, and so I decided that it would have to be me. And so because of my interest with in Mexican philosophy and the history of philosophy in Mexico, and my own cultural embeddedness, I decided that this was going to be a philosophical project that I needed to take on.
And I'm glad you did. When talking about narco-culture, people often tend to think about Latin America, particularly Mexico or Colombia. However, you mentioned that this topic should also be of interest of U.S. philosophers. Please tell us why.
Yes, because Mexico is just down the street, literally, right, from the United States. So the idea that there was this, I call it a cultural modality, right, that there was this cultural modality, this phenomenon that was happening right down the street, to me seems like something that philosophies or philosophers interested in morality and politics in existence should pay attention to, because it's just right there. It's something that is affecting people right now, and it's something that's very close at hand for us. And so I always find it odd that philosophers like to focus on ethical and political issues that have passed, that are hundreds of years old, decades old, and or not even part of our current situation or circumstance. And so I wanted to make sure that we discussed this phenomenon that I thought was morally, politically, and existentially important for us.
And I hope several philosophers take your invitation, because definitely it's a topic that deserves more and more attention from different disciplines. And of course, philosophy should be one that could help us understand what is happening. And talking about these concepts that help us understand, let's talk about the use of brutality as a concept, which is at the core of your book. I want to start, like you did, focusing on an important remark you made before going more in depth of the analysis. You state that a culture of brutality is not a culture of brutes. You are very clear letting the readers know that you're not depicting those sectors of the Mexican communities which deal with narco-culture as savages or uncivilized. What are the dangers of this characterization?
Well, there's an immediate danger of talking about the culture of brutality in the context of talking about Mexico, is that people would immediately think that The reason why I'm calling it that is because it is Mexico, and then there's this implicit bias about Mexican culture itself that perhaps it is not as advanced or civilized as other countries, and therefore this kind of behavior or these kinds of cultural ways of being are just normal for that particular culture. That's the immediate danger, that to think that what I'm talking about is a culture that is primitive or uncivilized, right? But I try to make it clear that that is not at all what I'm talking about. Brutality and the cultural brutality that I'm depicting in the book is one that is a result or a direct result of civilization, of civilized cultures, of the neoliberal economic world systems. It is directly related to an advanced culture, advanced civilizations. And so my claim in several parts of the book is that narco-culture, narco-trafficking, and the violence that it requires need or necessitate or require advanced civilized economic systems. These kinds of things would not happen if those were not in place already. So that's the danger, to think that I'm equating those two things. And again, I'm not. I think that brutality is such an important concept that it could sneak up on us and it could infect and take over any society in any part of the world at any time.
And it might be hard to believe how common it is that people think that narco culture flourished in Mexico or in Latin America because we don't know how to behave. And I'm literally quoting a conversation I overheard in New York of people talking about drug trafficking. Somebody said, oh, this is never going to end because, you know, Mexicans, they just don't know how to behave. So it wasn't neoliberalism. There wasn't like politics. No, it was behavior. So that's what I thought. It was so important to talk about this at the beginning of the interview. And talking about things that seem familiar, we all might think we know what narco-culture is. It's like a concept that everybody's like, oh yeah, I know what it is. But nope, after I read your book, I confirmed once again how difficult and how complicated it is to define it. You tell us, for instance, that in spite of its overt violence, narco-culture represents economic and existential opportunities for people in marginalized communities, and that it is simultaneously a culture of both creation and destruction. Help us understand what narco-culture is or how it works from the perspective of your analysis.
Yeah, so I like to think of it as, I call it in the book a way of life, right? So it is a way of life, first of all. It's a culture that has its distinct ways of dressing, the distinct music. It has a distinct vocabulary or jargon, and it has its routines, the things that are done in that particular culture. For instance, the narco trafficking and the various violent regimes that are attached to that. But also it is a culture of creation, right? Because a lot of the messaging that comes out of that culture comes out through its music, right? For example. And narco corridos are insanely popular in the US, for example. People love the narco corridos, and not necessarily because they're talking about murder and brutality and violence, but because they're good songs, right? People like the music. And so I think that that kind of thing, it's a culture because it's creating cultural products. And so it's not just about the narco traffickers. I mean, that there's I can walk down the street here and where I live. I live in Hayward, California. And I can go down one of these streets and find people riding around in these big trucks, blasting the narco corridos. And then I could follow them down to the local carniceria, and they'll get down from their truck, and they work at Facebook or something like that. You know, they're Facebook employees. They're dressed in their regular California dress or whatever. So, anyways, I think what I'm trying to get at is that narco culture is a way of life where it's producing a different source of cultural product. Now, one of the things that I say in the book, I think that's like an after effect, right? That's something that narco culture leaves in its wake. It's something that we're gonna that all of us are receiving, right? These kind of cultural products. One of the things that I say when I'm trying to define narco culture in the book, which, as you put it, is very hard to do. Is that I'm saying that if you exist in that culture, it's not necessarily your choice that you exist in that culture. For example, if you go down to Culiacan or Sinaloa and different parts of Sinaloa, people are living everyday lives, doing everyday things, but the culture is on top of them, right? It's like they can't escape what this culture is about or what it's doing in their communities. They're just there. They live within the culture, and they have to do certain things to survive in that culture, not necessarily illegal things, but at the same time, they have to respect the rules that narco-culture has set up wherever it is that they live, right? So one of the things that I think about is one time when I went to Culiacan, I was being driven back to the airport, and obviously my driver was not a narco, but he was telling me as we drove down there about all the things that he couldn't do. Mm-hmm. Right, all the things that he was not allowed to do, because if he did them, you know, he'd get in trouble with the narcos. So in that sense, narco culture was already kind of dictating his own experiences on a day to day basis. It's setting rules and laws for them that allow them to survive, you know, the whatever economic system it is that we all live in. So it's, you know, I think I'm going around in circles here, but narco culture, I think, is a complex cultural way of life that involves many different things, including the violence and brutality that I talk about in the book, but also opportunities, right, for people to exist, to live out the difficulties of life in the world.
Yeah, no, definitely. And that's why I think your book is so interesting, because it helps us think one more time about the complexities of it. Even though, as you mentioned, violence is a central component of narco culture. So let's talk about the second chapter titled On Violence or a Primer on Narco Culture. It opens with an Arthur Schopenhauer quote, which reads, "Justice is in itself powerless. What rules by nature is force." Full disclosure, I'm a big fan of epigraphs. So when I have the opportunity, I ask authors why they used those quotes. So the question is, why did you use this Schopenhauer's quote to open your chapter, and how it is related to your analysis?
Yeah, good question. Yeah, I love epigraphs too. So
great.
that one I chose it because I wanted to talk about how violence was being used in the culture, in narco culture, how violence was setting up the rules for the culture itself. And so one of the things that the quote mentions is that what really sets down those rules is force, right? That's why I wanted to highlight, right? That in narco culture, what's going to create a just situation is going to be force, power, right? I think that it's very clear, right? We can talk about that in any other situation, but in that particular situation, it's very clear that the threat of force, the threat of violence, is what keeps things in place, right? Mm-hmm. And the paradox with narco culture is that the threat of violence keeps things in place, and violence itself keeps things in place, right? So it's both. And one of the things that I talk about in the book too is that violence is required to maintain the system that nurtures and operates the culture, right? So violence is required to do these things. You need to show force There needs to be a show of force, and there needs to be the threat of force. So there's, you know, there's all these different things going around there. And Schopenhauer was one of the only philosophers that I saw that was being very clear about that, to the point that I needed to use the epigraph.
And when reading your book, it is clear that the word violence does not capture the acts which take place as part of narco-culture. In fact, you demonstrate that some acts might be too cruel, too extreme. So you propose the concept of brutality. As part of this analysis, you gave an interesting example, and I quote, "The murder of a man is already a violent act, but the execution of the rest of his family for no other reason than to punish the already murdered man is more than violence and different from violence." Can you explain why you use brutality instead of violence, terror, or cruelty?
Yeah, good. I mean, that is at the heart of this book. And what I noticed growing up, right? When I was a kid, I had an uncle, my uncle Manuel, who all of a sudden stopped working here. He used to live around here in California, and he used to work in the orchards in Central California. And all of a sudden, he stopped working, but he was driving around very nice cars, right? He had very nice cars all the time. We came to find out that he was actually trafficking, right? He got involved with some people. He was trafficking down to Michoacán, and up and down, he was driving up and down all the time. And then at one point, he stopped coming. He disappeared. We didn't know where he was. My aunt was going a little crazy because she wanted to know where he was. Eventually, about 2 weeks after he went missing, they found him in a garbage dump in Uruapan, naked, and his body completely mutilated. Right? Mm. I was a kid, but I remember asking my mom, why did they do that to Uncle Manuel? And then her answer was, well, that's how they do things. She couldn't explain it. That's how they do things. And I kept wondering, like, why do that? Like, why don't it just, because he was also shot in the head. And I thought, why don't just shoot him in the head and leave him there? Like, what's that extra stuff for, right? And it wasn't that they were trying to send a message, because they threw him in the garbage, right? They wanted him to disappear after they shot him in the head and brutalized him. So that idea kind of stuck with me for years. And so when I was writing the book, that's the first thing that I thought about. Okay, what is that extra stuff for? Right? So you have this violent act, and then you decide to do this extra thing, or to do this violent act in this extra violent way. And why, right? So there's another example that I read about where these narcos went into a village in Michoacán, and they were killing the babies. Right? They killed a bunch of babies. And the way they would do it is the way that you kill a rabbit. And I don't know if you were ever around somebody killing a rabbit. When I was growing up, my dad would grab the rabbit by the ears and hold it up and just hit it in the back of the head, and the rabbit would die. Well, that's what they were doing to these kids, right? But instead of the ears, they were holding them by the feet. Now, why? Why this extra stuff? The answer to that question is not something that I will ever find out. But what that shows is that there is this extra stuff, this extra violence that is completely unnecessary, that's excessive, right? It's an excessive violence that is not captured by the concepts that we have of violence. So in chapter two, when I'm talking about all these different kinds of violence, the theories of violence, all these theories of violence from Hannah Arendt to Zizek to all of these other people, they don't capture that extra stuff, that excessiveness, right? Or they don't, the concepts themselves fail, right? They break down because they don't capture that extra stuff, that excessiveness. And so that's why I decided, well, no, violence is not going to cut it. Like the concept of violence is too abstract, or it's too specific, or it's too worn out, it's weak. So we need this other concept. And so I chose brutality because, and then I defined it as, okay, so this is going to include this other stuff, this excessiveness that's not accounted for in violence, that extra thing that people do. That's not necessarily cruelty either, right? Because cruelty is, as I say in the book, I make a distinction between brutality and cruelty. And I say that cruelty is a very individual thing. It belongs to people. And with cruelty, you're trying to do something or commit an act of a violent act and make sure that everybody knows that you did that, right? And so it's a reflection of your own personality. Whereas brutality, according to the philosopher Max Scheler, doesn't aim to do those things. Brutality is a violent act that at the same time dehumanizes the person so that it doesn't seem like a violent act, right? So you turn a person into an object, and then when you hit that person, when you stab that person, when you shoot that person, you're not hitting or stabbing or shooting a person, you're hitting, stabbing, or shooting an object. And that's why it's so easy to do those extra things to those people or those, you know, pseudo people at that point. And so that's why I thought that brutality was a better concept. Because I got that concept, I got that distinction from Scheler, and then I saw the phenomenon that was going on with narco culture with this excessiveness. And then I applied the concept to that. So that's why I chose that concept. And I'll say one more thing too. This idea that brutality dehumanizes the other person in order to justify the violence is not something that you find in other concepts or other phenomena like terror, right? Because the first thing somebody's going to say is, well, that sounds like terror. But terrorism depends on having you know that the person that you're killing is a person. Because the only way that I'm going to terrorize you is by making you very afraid. And the way that you're going to become afraid is if I show you that this could happen to you, right? I want to maintain the humanity of the victim so that you can see it, right? And be filled with terror. What I'm saying in the book is that brutality doesn't do that. In fact, brutality wants to dehumanize the other person so that you don't feel anything about it, right? So when, and I had different conversations with my mom about this and over the years, right? When something on Univision comes on, oh, they killed 15 narcos. And my mom would say all the time, pues en eso andaban. Right. Mm-hmm. That's, well, you know, we know what they were getting. We know that they were into something bad, right? So that they killed them is no big deal. That reaction points directly to the dehumanization that goes on in brutality and why that violence is accepted at the end of the day.
Yeah, and we could record another podcast just talking about the consequences of mm-hmm. that reaction, right? Like, okay, they were narcos. It's what they had it coming. It would happen anyway. But let's keep talking about brutality, because you also mentioned that brutality leaves us speechless. And I couldn't agree more. I think this is one of the parts of your book in which I connected the most. You know, you were talking about all of these brutal acts, and it's difficult to try to think about following the conversation. And sometimes you read them, and yeah, brutality leaves us speechless. And you said it forces us to keep three silences: the silence of shock, the silence of indifference, and the silence of renunciation. Tell us more about it, please.
Yeah, well, I think that it's important to think of brutality rendering us speechless, because for me, at least, it shows what it does, right? It shows what an excessively violent act accomplishes. And what it accomplishes is that we run out of ways to describe it, right? We, first of all, in the moment of shock, you don't know what to say, right? We say this all the time. It's an everyday thing. If I see something bad happen outside my house, I'll say I don't even know what to say about that. And then there's this other moment where you see it often enough, right? You see the violence often enough, brutality often enough, that you become immune to it. You become numb to it, right? You no longer, it's not that you don't have anything to say. You don't want to say anything, right? Because it's happened so much, like, oh man, not again, right? Okay. I'll just continue living my life. I'm not going to say anything about that. And then there's that renunciation thing too, where you just believe that this is going to happen for the rest of time. Right? This is something that I cannot help, something that I cannot say anything about. It's done. Like, okay, I'm just going to continue living my life, and that's that. But the most important thing, I think, to keep in mind with this notion that brutality render us speechless, is that we are invited by brutality to not say anything, right? It's not necessarily to keep quiet, but it takes the words away from us, right? And that's part of its logic. In a brutal culture, a brutal society, whether that's narco culture or somewhere in Ohio in the United States, where violence and brutality are actual facts of life, it's the dehumanization aspect of it makes it so that we don't have anything to say about it, right? Because it's so common, and it's such a normal way of life that we just don't have words to describe it. And when we try to describe it, it comes out like something that people are already familiar with. And I think that in a lot of these cases, people are not familiar with these things. And what words do, when we try to describe something, what words do is that they make it acceptable in a certain way, right? Or they take away the horror of it. They take away the brutality of it, the shock that you should feel. They take all those things away. So I think that when I say that brutality renders us speechless, I mean that we lack the words to talk about it, and so we just don't. Right? We just don't, and what happens with that is that it then continues, right? It perpetuates itself. It continues to be the thing that it is. Society continues to go down that road. The violence continues to mount. Deaths and murder and all of that stuff continue because we just don't want to talk about it anymore. And so I think that that's one of the, I don't have any like lessons in the book. Like I don't try to give anybody any recommendations as to how to proceed, because I consider the text to be something of a phenomenology. So I'm just trying to describe what's going on in this philosophical way. So I'm not giving any like prescriptive moral advice as to how to go on. But I think that if there was something that I could say about that, it would be, if we learn anything from the book, is that silence is complicit, right, with brutality. And so we shouldn't be silent. We should speak, even if brutality and violence and whatever is trying to take the words out of our mouths.
Yeah, you are completely, completely right. Well, definitely your book made me think a lot, particularly the last chapter, which I found really complex. And I think it's a chapter one can revisit several times. And it is titled On Personhood or El Pozole, Toward the Absolute Derealization of the Other. In there, you talk about the brutality paradox. How are objectification and dehumanization related to this paradox? And probably most important for this chapter, what is the derealization of the other?
Yeah, so I take that concept of derealization from an American philosopher named Judith Butler. And Judith Butler is talking about homosexuals that are dehumanized in society because they are homosexuals, and then she focuses on those that have AIDS, right? Or that died during the AIDS epidemic. And the idea is that if we want to derealize a person, if we want to take away their reality, what we do is that we turn them into an idea, right? We convert the person into an idea. And the way that we do that is through statistics, right? Or is through narratives that try to capture entire groups as entities, right? So we can say, oh, well, what did your cousin die of? Well, he died of AIDS in the 1980s. He was a homosexual, right? And immediately when you say that, you get rid of the reality of your cousin, and he becomes just an abstract idea that was part of that narrative about gays dying from AIDS in the 1980s. And so I get that idea that derealization, and I apply it to what's going on in narco-culture, or to a particular practice that was happening in narco-culture that I'm sure still goes on. And that's the concept of pozole. I'm turning somebody into soup, right? And the idea was that a practice amongst narcos was to disappear other people by putting them in barrels of diesel or acid and basically dissolving them to the point where nothing remained of them. And my claim in the book is that not only did we derealize them by turning them into narcos that, as my mom said, knew what they were getting into. So that's the first derealization. The second one is when we put them in this barrel, and now their entire humanity is completely gone. So there's this derealization that goes on in narco-culture where the person is derealized first by being grouped into a stereotype. And then there's a second derealization that is really an act of brutality, right? Where you completely disfigure, completely derealize, completely destroy the other person. And so in my eyes, that entire practice really puts into question what we understand about personhood, right? What does it mean to be a person? Well, it means all these things, but look how fragile it is. Look how fragile this concept is, because I could completely depersonalize you, derealize you by categorizing you in some random way, or I could put you in this barrel of acid and you'll completely be gone forever, disappeared, maybe remain a memory in your mom's mind or something. And so there's this, you know, I wanted to point out that brutality has this power to create conditions for the dehumanization and the derealization of persons. Now, I try to be optimistic, or not optimistic, but I try to end up in a positive note at some point in that chapter by saying, but you know, the human body, the human person is very hard to get rid of, right? Like, not only does the memory remain in somebody's mind, but you know, it's hard to get rid of. It's hard to completely erase you from the face of the planet, as happened to the guy who they used to call El Pozolero, who was eventually caught after doing this to maybe 1,000 people. And the way that they caught them is because the moms of some of these missing people showed up to where he was working, and they found little pieces of teeth or little pieces of bone just scattered on the ground, and they were able to then identify the person after that. So even though they tried really, really hard to derealize a person, there's this human resilience that can transcend all those efforts to get rid of you completely from the face of the earth. And I think that was like my uptake in that chapter.
Yeah, definitely. And it's difficult not to think also about how this complete derealization or trying to erase a person, don't erase them from the mind of their mothers or their loved ones, who are the ones that are going to be looking for this body that somebody tries to disappear. Mm-hmm. Right, because it's kind of taking away not only their body, but these rituals of grief. You touch upon on that. Can you tell us a little bit more about
it? Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we were all embedded in different social, we were all products of rituals and cultural forms of life, right? We're all embedded in them. We're all part of ways of understanding that make us who we are and make us intelligible to other people. I think that one of the most impactful ways that brutality derealizes persons is by, first of all, dehumanizing them to the point that they're no longer humans, but also trying to disappear them from the face of the earth. And if you disappear someone from the face of the earth, then you really can't, as you say, you can't mourn them. You don't know where they are. So you can't say that they're dead. And if you say that they're dead, there's always going to be a doubt in you that maybe they're not. So true mourning can't take place in a situation where you have no knowledge of what happened to your loved one. And so I think that's one of the cruelest things about this particular act of pozolear somebody, right? It's cruel because it's trying to make your loved ones suffer unnecessarily, right? You're trying to not allow them to mourn, to not allow them to go on, right? Because you're kind of stuck somewhere, not knowing anything, in this limbo space. And to me, that's just, I just can't imagine it. It would be horrifying to not know what happened to somebody that I loved. And so I think that once these mothers find traces of their missing ones, that's why it allows for the closure that we talk about, right? We talk about, oh yeah, well, now they can have closure. Well, yeah, it allows it because now, even though it's a hair, even though it's a fingernail, right, you know something. You know that that person was murdered in that way. And now you can mourn them. Now you can light the candles. Now you can go on with your life, right? So I think part of the lessons here is that there is a lot of resiliency amongst human communities, and especially in narco culture, right? Because again, to go back to the beginning, narco culture is not just about violence and brutality and narco trafficking, right? There's people that exist in that culture that probably don't want to exist in that culture, but they still exist in that culture, that survive in that culture. And they do so by through different practices, different rituals, and different ways to exist. And I think that that shows that it's not a subculture like some people call it. It's a culture, right? And there's different things that are going on in that culture, including keeping memories alive, including different rituals of mourning and worship, literature and poetry, and that are belong specifically to that culture. And that's why I wanted to make that point that narco culture is not a subculture, it's a culture, right? And whether we like it or not, is a culture that is spreading, right? I see it down the street here in Hayward. I see it everywhere that I go. And so it's not something that's going away. I think that if anything, it's becoming more accepted in different places.
Yes, definitely. And well, I want to end this conversation talking about the book itself. Can you tell the audience where to find it? And my second related question it is, have you thought about translating your book in Spanish?
Well, I would love to translate it into Spanish, but I don't want to do it myself.
Well, some editors, I will ask your editors about it, or somebody else can take this invitation, please.
Yes, yes, yes. Please do that, because I would love it to. I think that it would be something that that would find interest in Mexico. I mean, I presented a lot of these a couple of these chapters in Culiacán in a conference on violence, and so I think that it's something that a lot of people would find very interesting, especially my particular take on the whole thing, which I still claim is very philosophical. That's the answer to that. I really hope that it does achieve that that translated version of it. Now, as to where to find it, it's free. The book is free. It's open access, so you can download it off the internet. If you go to Amherst College Press and then just look up for A Sense of Brutality, and then it gives you the instructions as to how to download it for free. But if you're the kind of person like myself that likes to have a book in their hand and read, you can also order it from their website, and that one is going to cost like $15. But it was a great opportunity for me to publish in this format, because I felt like it would reach the largest possible audience, and that's what I wanted. Again, because I thought that a phenomenon like this needed to be highlighted and discussed in a philosophical way by more people. So that's why I decided to use that press, which I'm very happy I did.
I also hope your book reaches a lot of people. Please, the invitation is there. The book is open access. And Carlos, I want to thank you for being on the show today, but I don't want to let you go without asking you, what are you working on now? If you are working on other projects, please tell us.
Yeah, so... like I said, my major interest is Mexican thought, Mexican philosophy and culture. And so right now I am working on a book that I handed in the manuscript today, this morning.
Hi, congratulations.
yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's a book on Mexican philosophy for a wider audience. So it's written in a way that, you know, hopefully everybody will be able to understand. What makes the book unique and interesting, I think, is that I spend half of the time talking about my parents, right? Mm-hmm. Which, you know, again, it's like philosophy shouldn't be doing these kinds of things, or philosophers shouldn't be, or we're told that philosophers shouldn't be doing this. But I feel like the only way that I can explain philosophy is by applying it to my own life. So I have a lot of stories there about my grandfather and my parents and my siblings and my life as a Mexican-American in the United States. And so I just submitted that manuscript. The book is going to be called A Blooming in the Ruins. And it's going to be about an easy, accessible way to understand Mexican philosophy. So hopefully at some point people will read that too.
Well, I'm happy you are doing the things that are not supposed to be done, because I found your project really, really interesting. And you have our contact, so let us know when the book is published. And if you want to talk about it, we'll be more than happy to have you here again. But in the meantime, thank you very much for sharing your time with us in English and in Spanish. Thank you very much, Carlos.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much, Pamela, for inviting me.
And I also want to thank everybody for listening to this episode about A Sense of Brutality, Philosophy After Narcoculture. For New Books Network in Philosophy, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Pamela Fuentes. Until next time, Hasta la próxima.